Welcome to Semiobites, bite-sized podblog episodes related to theological semiotics.
So, we are doing a revision, like a review, I guess, of semiotics and what that means for you, what that means for me. I believe you've got more of the, I'm sorry, textbook, but philosophical viewpoint on it.
There's some truth to that. I certainly build all of my theory of science around Charles Sanders Peirce, the American philosopher, 19th century mainly. 1839 to 1914 was his lifespan. He's really a tragic figure. I've been reading this great book by Joseph Brent, which is the definitive biography. The biography itself has its own kind of shadowy story, but I won't go into that. But Peirce was a real tragic figure. I won't dwell on his biography, but I do recommend the book. It's called Charles Sanders Peirce, A Life, and the author is Joseph Brent, Indiana University Press, 1998. It's an excellent book, a real capstone to my thesis work.
You should include the link to that in your follow-up blog post about our conversation.
I will do that.
And then just as a reminder for listeners that Terry and I chat here for Semiobites, but then we also both feature a follow-up blog post on our individual blogs. The links are available at semiobites.com.
That's true. I will confess and plead mea culpa that I haven't done as good a job keeping up as you have, Yoni, but I'm getting back up to speed as this dissertation draws to a close. It's in the home stretch, and I should put it in the stall by the end of next month.
You know, I think what my thing is, I like to write a lot. It's horrible. Just how much I enjoy writing. And it's like, if I don't get to write this out, if I don't get to think about it, I go nuts inside. And it just becomes fractured. Like, there's so much in me that I need to be able to express it somewhere to put it down. I think that's why I like to blog.
Yeah. Well, you know, you once said, and it rather mystified me, I've never been able to finish anything I've started in writing. So everything is always an ongoing revision. I never have a finished draft. Now, I have things that have made it into publication in print. And so, I consider those finished articles. But if I bring up my soft copy of those pieces, I have to change them. I have to start editing. And you once said you never wrote anything but finished draft. And I'm wondering how well that's holding true for your dissertation.
So, today's revision is marked draft number 21.
I'm kind of poking a button there. I know I'm really kind of poking fun at you because I knew that I suspected this dissertation would kind of throw a monkey wrench in the finished draft first time process.
Oh, well, it definitely had to. You know, it's such a massive document, and what I'm trying to accomplish is it's such a big thing, Jewish-Christian relations, that for me, just to throw a rough draft out there and call it final and good, that does nobody any justice on the topic.
Right, and what I'm finding, just in trying to cover semiotics and Christianity, especially in the point of view of philosophy, science, and theology, it's a moving target. Every time I think I've finished, I get up and read some news the next morning. I'm going, wait a minute. Now that's wrong in my paper, you know? So it is a moving target. But anyway, like you said, we were going to revisit or kind of have a refresher here on the basics of the theory of signs, also known as semiotics. And the basic definition, if I think the way Peirce would have it, is that it's something that stands for something for somebody. Now, that's about as vague a definition of something as you can get, but it does get to the heart of the matter, namely in that phrase, stands for. Anything can stand for anything for somebody. So pretty much anything can be a sign in that very broad, general, ambiguous sense. The basic example, or the most familiar example, of course, is our own language. There are over 7,000 languages, almost 7,100 languages, natural, ordinary, everyday vernacular languages in use around the world. And that's one kind of sign system. Those are all symbols, symbolic systems. And the distinguishing characteristic of symbolic systems is they stand for things for no other reason than we say they do. Their meaning is completely arbitrary. It's entirely up to us as the sign users to decide what symbols stand for our alphabet and the words that we make out of that alphabet, the sentences and phrases and paragraphs and stories and tales and books and all that that we write and read and speak. That's all one symbol system at work. Well, 7,100 symbol systems at work of all the 7,100 languages, but they're all, what they all have in common is their symbol systems. In other words, signs that we assign meaning to according to our habits and conventions. I did learn a new word that's worth sharing, socioecology, which basically means the way a community of beings relates to their ecological environment. And language systems, symbol systems, is a very socio-ecological system. It's a big part of how we as a community, by convention and habit of our language, relate to the world we live in.
All right.
Is there a good Yiddishkeit version of that idea?
I think so. You and I have talked about it a bit in the past and everything. I'm going to present a couple of them, so bear with me here.
Okay.
When I'm talking to Jewish individuals, and I bring up semiotics, and they look at me like, "What does that mean?" I have stopped saying, "Oh, well, you know, it means a study of science," because we know that's not very accurate. And I, for a period, was trying to say, well, simanim is signs in Hebrew, and it's referring to that. What does something mean beyond the something? And I stopped doing that as well, because I think that the individuals found it too literal. And what I started doing is what Len Sweet really has done in our coursework and everything. And I look at them and say, semiotics is the discussion of metaphor within Torah.
It's good.
And then they stop and they get it. They're like, oh, because metaphor within Torah is a big Jewish thing. We believe it's literal and metaphoric, and we're constantly looking for the hidden metaphors, and what are we supposed to know about that? We have an entire oral Torah, the Talmud, that's dedicated to metaphor hunting. So that helps in that regard. Ways to translate that is within Kabbalah, which is our spiritual mysticism or the relationship with God aspect, we have what's called pardes. Pardes means garden, and it's metaphoric. It's not a literal garden, it's a metaphoric garden. And that's represented by the letters Pshat, Remez, Thrash, and Sod. And in the past, we talked about these. And then I recently did a blog post, The Vessel, over at Yidbrook, and I moved some things around, and that caused another conversation, which I think is what led part two, we really need to hash this out again, which is from a older Jewish perspective, so the sages, so to say, like Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Maimonides and those individuals from a longer time ago when they're writing these foundational texts that we still use today. They'd say Peshat is the first layer of understanding. It's the simple meaning or the straight surface, because that's what Peshat means, is surface. Yeah, this level interprets what it is as of what it sounds. So a vessel, for example, in my blog post, is a boat. That's the simple, plain, literal meaning. That's Peshat. That's what we get when we take Torah literally. Oh, this literally happened. So Joseph laid down his head on this rock and went to sleep and dreamed of a ladder, so to say. The ladder, I guess, is a little metaphoric going into that. But the idea that he laid down on a rock and had a dream. And then we've got Remez. Now, Remez, this is where I kind of tossed a curveball in there, because the sages are saying that Remez is very much the metaphor or a symbolic meaning that's beyond the literal sense. And this is secular semiotics, the way I've interpreted it. Not necessarily religious semiotics, but this is where most of secular semiotics dwells. Because semiotics is about studying the signs and metaphor and everything, and what's being symbolized by the symbol type thing. And so from how most people understand the plain meaning of semiotics, I think this fits that. Which is that rock represents something more than a rock. And then the question is, what does it represent? And that takes us into Drash. Drash is the Midrashic meaning. And this is something that's beyond simple or symbolic, bit in our experience with Lens Suite's class, I think this is a little closer to the semiotic lens that he's having here, and that we have two things going on. First, we have the exegetical process here, where we say, well, this matches these other things. Here's where it's cross-referenced. This book refers to this book. Here's a connection. What's going on here? But then we also take that another lens farther, and we say, for example, the vessel, right? Vessel was historically meant, or let's talk about the rock. What is the rock meaning? What is beyond the symbolism of the rock? Where else are rocks showing up in scripture, and what is the bigger connection here? But I think what you're looking for is that final level sowed. And we've talked in the past, and we've attributed semiotics to being in here, but the sages don't want to go that far. And they don't want to go that far because they think that sowed really is a limited capacity that not very many people can get at. And if we label semiotics in there, then we're saying most people who really can't understand semiotics, at least from the sages' perspective. And they're saying, for example, so does the secret wisdom. It's beyond esoteric and it's mystical. It's like this divine revelation, this perfect inspiration. Mm-hmm. They call it the Chokhmah Be'emet, which is the true wisdom. And that's what Kabbalah is, the true wisdom. And what it's saying is there's something here that a prophet would get, or a really holy man would get, or Moses would get. Mm-hmm. And they're looking for that type of thing. Now, I believe that people can have a relationship with Hashem, not necessarily at the level of Moses, but we can have a relationship with Hashem and he can inspire us. Mm-hmm. The sages are saying that type of inspiration is a little bit before Sod. They're trying to say that this type of inspiration is the equivalent of, well, I guess your Krishna equivalent is you got Jesus and the apostles there, and the apostles say something and Jesus is like, well, that's not it entirely. It's this other thing over here. And the apostles blink and say, what? Because there's that level that they didn't even know existed.
Right.
Does that make sense?
It does. It does. And it resonates with some other ideas. If I understand you correctly, you're basically saying that semiotics can be applied, albeit differently with respect to the differences, it can be applied to the first three layers of the Pardes. The Peshat, the, what's next? Remez.
Yeah.
And then Darash, right?
Yes.
You're saying it can apply through those three, and as far as it can go, though, stops just short of Sod.
Well, personally, I'm saying it doesn't apply to Peshat. Peshat, when you're looking at Peshat, it's so simple. It's so plain. There's nothing semiotic to it. And it's, oh, my, I see this wall. That's a wall. Remez and Drash is where the sages are saying this is the primary area where semiotics dwells. Yeah. And I guess what I'm saying is I see it within Remez and Drash, and then I see suggestions of it in Sod, but I'm hesitant to say that it's in Sod so much that everybody jumps to believe in that they have this divine inspiration, right, in which they can sit down and they can write a brand new book of the Bible.
Right, right, right.
I mean, we've seen that happen in history. It doesn't work.
I would back away from that myself, even from a Persian perspective. And from what I've learned of Peirce most recently, I think he would too. He wouldn't say it isn't semiotic, but he would say it is an extremely esoteric semiotic category, if you will. The word symbolic is what's getting kind of nebulous here. Give you an example of how nebulous it can be. When we talk about something like I was going to say the American flag, but let's be a little less contentious. Let's say the flag of, pick an obscure country,
Scandinavia.
Lithuania. Yeah, Lithuania will be fine. Whatever the national flag is of Lithuania, it doesn't look like Lithuania, you know? I don't think there's a map of Lithuania or a photograph from a space telescope of Lithuania on their flag. So it has no visual resemblance to the country. Okay. And there's no real causal connection. If I set fire to the flag of Lithuania, the country's not going to go up in flames. Likewise, I could blow the country up and there would still be flags of Lithuania flying at the United Nations. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So the meaning of that flag as a piece of cloth woven a certain way with certain patterns of ink in the weave is purely symbolic. It means what it means because we say it does. Okay? It has no iconic resemblance. There's no similarity or familiarity to it beyond its symbolism. Right? When you look at the Statue of Liberty, okay, that stands for, symbolizes an American ideal. But visually, iconically, as an image, it's a woman in a robe holding a tablet and a torch. We have symbolized that image, added symbolic meaning to that iconic image to stand for the American concept of liberty. You see what I'm saying? And that notion of icon and symbol from a semiotic perspective can get kind of murky. Athletes who are stars become cultural icons. They stand for certain cultural roles that are heroic, but that's symbolic meaning. Heroic figures, whether they're rock stars or movie stars or political figures, pick your news figures of the day, their symbolism is what's making them familiar icons. They only look like themselves, you know? They may have a twin sister or a brother. They may have siblings. They may have a doppelganger somewhere on the planet that they look like, but that resemblance has nothing to do with their cultural iconicity, which is really cultural symbolism, if you follow what I'm saying. Some people say, for instance, that I look like Jack Nicholson. I don't think it's true, but I would take it as a compliment if it were. He's pretty ugly, and nevertheless, he's a cultural icon. He symbolizes a certain kind of character and persona in our culture. It has nothing to do really with the way he looks. It has to do with who he is. And that being of who he is takes on a symbolic kind of cultural significance. And that's what it is to be a cultural icon, is to be a thing that has a physical appearance, but added to that a physical appearance is this layer of cultural meaning that goes beyond just physical appearance. Now, relating that back to what you were saying, there's a triad or a trichotomy that is the philosophical and intellectual foundation of all of Peirce's theory. And it's divided into three categories: firstness, secondness, and thirdness. And those are three important things. And I indicated to you that I felt like they lined up kind of, at least in, there was a kind of harmony between those categories of Peirce's and some or all of the categories of the Pardus. It's hard to explain other than to say that firstness has to do with quantity, and it has to do with material. Like if I just draw a mark on a piece of paper, it has firstness. It's a material thing, and it has the possibility of standing for something else, but it doesn't. It's just a line on a piece of paper. It's a material thing, and it has a quality, namely it's linear, et cetera, et cetera. Now, when I connect that line to another line, I now have a line in relation to another line, and I've moved from quantity further into quality, and I've moved from just firstness into secondness because there's a relation now between those two things. And that's what I was kind of hearing you say, that when you move from the Peshat to the Ramez, there's a relational thing starting to happen. You read this about the stone that he laid his head on to sleep, and you start relating that to other mentions of stone in scripture to try to tie meaning together. Is that right?
Yeah. So that's part of it. You know, that's the second level and the third level working together there.
Right. And that's what I'm thinking. There's a kind of secondness from Peirce's perspective at work in that. A lot more to both of these than either of us can cover in 15 or 20 minutes.
Yeah.
But anyway, nevertheless, those three notions of the icon, the index, and the symbol, and we've only really only talked about the icon and the symbol from Peirce's perspective, those are the three basic and most familiar kinds of signs that you encounter when you start reading about or having discussions about semiotics. Icons are signs that stand for the things they stand for because they look like them or resemble them or are familiar to our experience. A whole lot of our sensory cognition, just before we think about it, the way we experience things without thinking about it, colors, temperatures, shapes, you know, just the raw what Peirce called the brute factuality of things. Those are sensory or cognitive icons because we recognize, we recognize them because they're familiar. They resemble prior experience, see? So they're iconic. A whole lot of our sensory experience in life is iconic in that sense. Symbolic, like I say, is whatever we want to say a thing stands for. That's what it stands for. And if others can agree with us, we've now established a habit or a convention. And that's where all these 7,000 languages come from, is symbolic systems. The other category is the index. And it's also ambiguous, unfortunately. In I think the strongest sense of the term is cause and effect. Smoke stands for fire. Fire stands for smoke. Wind stands for waves on the water or waves in the grass or the leaves of the trees and so on. Wherever there's a cause-effect relationship, gravity waves emanating from a white dwarf star implosion, you know, these kinds of cause and effect relations that are pervasive in the whole universe. That basic causal structure of the universe is what indexicality means, or what an indexical sign refers to in its broad, strongest meaning, I think. But Peirce also used it to mean something as simple as pointing. Like if I say, you see that house over there and point to it? Literally, my index finger is an index to that house. It has that simple and primitive a meaning. The cursor when you move your mouse around on the screen of your computer, or your pad when you move your finger around to direct where you want to go. You're indexing the surface of that device and indexing its content when you do that. You see what I mean? So it has that kind of weaker sense of just a pointer and that stronger sense of any causal connection. Now, I'm mostly interested in the causal connection because that's what science is all about, is discovering causal laws. So that's why the indexicality of Peirce is such an important concept for what I'm trying to do in my dissertation. How does that work? How does indexicality and causation come through in Pardes?
I don't think there's a simple way to answer that at all. Not remotely close.
That's fair. It's not an easy case. It's not an easy concept.
Kabbalah is so mystical. And Pardes is a cornerstone of how Kabbalah works. And there's so much to it that, we could spend hours on this, and I don't even think we'd even scratch a surface, to be honest.
Well, that's not a bad thing, because really all I wanted to do was to accomplish two purposes in this conversation. That was to remind anyone who happens to listen to this pod blog and read our posts of what the basic three kinds of signs are, and at a very simple, primitive level, what they do and how they work. So I think we've done that. I also wanted to use that simple reminder to point to just how complicated this stuff gets when you start taking it apart and peeling back the layers. It just keeps getting deeper. And I've been studying Peirce now for going on 30 years, and it's not full time, but in and out, ebb and flow of concentration, especially in the last 3 to 5 years, I've been focused on it. And it's just phenomenal just how much he accomplished. The biography reveals, by the way, and it's a contentious issue in the community of Peirce scholars, but the biographer pretty clearly revealed that he, and clearly believes that Peirce was a Christian, that he had a mystical experience in April 1892, where he felt compelled to go to church. He was christened Episcopalian as a youth or as a child, but he never really found much comfort in the church, though occasionally he would feel kind of unsettled by that discomfort, but he never did really do much about it. But at one point in his life in 1892, when he felt his life was on the verge of ruin, this nagging compulsion came over him over a couple of nights of sleepless nights. And when the third morning he got up and had breakfast and found himself wandering around looking for a church. And he went in and had this mystical, transductive, transincarnational experience. And he wrote a letter to the rector about it, which is in the biography. And 6 years later, he wrote about it. And it's very clearly, from the way he describes the experience, very clearly an encounter with the Messiah, the Christ, as he would see it. Now, I don't know how people could read that part of his writings and read it any other way. But anyway, that's just kind of a footnote.
Okay. Well, I'd feel remiss if I wasn't able to finish telling you about the rock that Jacob
said. Oh, please. Please do.
So here, we're going to apply some semiotic parades to this real quick, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And if anybody feels like finding the information online, OU, the Orthodox Union, they are OU.org. If you just search for Starbucks and the Lesson of Jacob's Pillow, you'll get a story within a story that combines the two and connects it to the Holocaust, which is really amazing. But I'm using this as my reference point so people can find it. But it's actually a Midrashic tale.
And you'll put it in your blog post, right?
Yes, I will include a link to this in the follow-up blog post. So, parties. Again, we've got shot, which is our very simple plane. Oh, there's a stone. Jacob laid his head on it. And then we dive in to the next level. We go into Remes. We're saying, what's the symbolic meaning beyond a literal sense here? What's going on? Is there any signs and metaphor we need to pay attention to? And the sages are saying, yes, it's all over the place here. And that's where they actually say, okay, we got something going on here. It's not one stone. It's many stones. And we see these many stones happen throughout other spots. We have Rashi, one of the sages, and this is Genesis 28 we're looking at. He says in his commentary on it, that the stones began to fight with each other. And I'm sitting here thinking, okay, wait, so Jacob, he gathers stones as he tries to make a pillow, which doesn't sound very comfortable. And now we have Rashi over here, this sage, saying they fought. I'm thinking, okay, stones are fighting with each other. I guess the rocks do cry out in some regards. This is where we get into Drash, that third level, which is the Midrashic story and the exegesis and all that. And the Midrash itself describes this fight. So the stones began to quarrel with each other, one saying, upon me shall the righteous Jacob place his head. And the other said, let him lay upon me. Immediately, the Holy One, blessed be he, made them into one stone. Okay. So we have a Midrash saying, here's these stones, these 12 stones, fighting over who gets to be the pillow. And so then Hashem goes, well, let's make you into one stone. So then all the stones are the pillow all the same time as one stone. So we can take this. This is what the important part is, in my opinion, with semiotics. If we leave this story here, if we leave this Midrash here, we don't actually learn how it can work in our own lives. We're learning knowledge for the sake of knowledge. But if we can take it, and it have something to apply to us. We're not taking knowledge just for knowledge, but we're taking knowledge to propel us forward into a deeper level and a deeper relationship in many aspects. So Maimonides comments about these 12 stones. It says that Jacob gathered exactly 12 stones, and that's symbolic for the 12 tribes of Israel.
Here's what it is.
Yes. So the sages, and I'm referring to this page here to give you a quick summary at it. The sages are saying Jacob's cold and he's afraid and he's looking for some rest. And so there's these stones quarreling with each other. Each one wants to be the comfort. So then God takes them and makes them one. The Midrash teaches, oh, you can lean on me, I'm here for you. But it goes a little farther and says that every single person, our job is to go out there and provide support and provide help and take care of those who are in need of comfort. And then when we do that, all of us individuals doing that, we become one united front and we become one main stone that brings warmth, comfort, blessing, pretty much light to the nations type stuff. That happened. And the next morning after the dream, Jacob built an altar there. Here's where it's very interesting that we can learn something. And this is where it's like, whoa, maybe there is some sub-level stuff going here. Where did he have this dream? Where did he lay on these rocks? According to the sages, they say this, Genesis 28:17, it says this is the entrance to heaven, right? So this is the gateway to heaven. And within Judaism, we've got gateways. And there are 50 gateways, 49 are accessible, 49 different ways man can reach to God. And then the 50th gateway is reserved for God, and that's how God reaches to man. And he said, here's this gate, this entrance to heaven. And that's where they built the temple.
Interesting. That's interesting.
So we have all these
Jacob's 12 sons that were the fathers of the 12 tribes, right?
Yes-ish. We have Joseph, who has a half-tribe of Manasseh, and all that jazz there.
Right. It's a little... right.
But yeah, essentially, yes, Jacob, Israel, the father of all the nations, father of all the tribes within those groups in the land. We can see if we look at, okay, so our knowledge says temple, right? That's nice, that's good. What does it mean for me? Well, what it means for me is this. What is the purpose of the temple? How can I apply this to myself? The temple was where we made offerings to God. Even within Judaism, we don't do animal sacrifices today. Our offerings to God is prayer. So we're saying, okay, we're going to go to where God connects and comforts to us. And at that spot, we're going to pray to him and he's going to answer us.
That's fascinating.
We get all that from the story of the stones.
Fascinating.
So to me, that's a little bit of scriptural semiotics, I guess.
Yeah, that's pretty good. I like that. And it did work through all four levels very nicely.
The thing that boggles my mind is that I didn't grow up with Yiddishkeit, with Jewish heritage. I've had to be an outsider looking in and learning all this. What boggles my mind is, you know, having gone through my Christian phase and everything, I didn't know this story, but for the average Jew, oh yeah, that happened. I'm like, goodness, there's a lot on the semiotics teaching me here, and you're like, oh yeah, that happened, we know that already.
Yeah, but did they know it as semiotics?
Not as that word, no. That's just part of their Yiddishkeit.
I see. Part of the Yiddish socio-ecology.
Yeah, it's their tradition they pass down. Some of it written, some of it oral, from generation to generation to today.
Yeah. Well, that's outstanding. Good point to wrap up on.
So it sounds like you and I both have some writing to do.
Yes, sir. Between writing our dissertations, you mean.
Yes, that is true. The writing never ends.
It is a pleasure. And it's always a pleasure to have these conversations with you, Yoni.
You as well, Terry. And we will talk again soon.
Looking forward to it.
Send questions, comments, and suggestions to semiobites@gmail.com. Semiobites is a podcast co-hosted by Yidbrick and Semio City that answers Semitic questions via semiotic analysis by addressing misunderstandings to build a bridge of shalom between Judaism and Christianity. Semiobites is a component of the Track 2 dissertation process at Portland Seminary for Jonathan Esterman and Terry Rankin.